My mother looked up, her eyes widened in amazement, and then she screamed in complete horror. "Begone, ghost," she howled at me. "Revenant, fiend." Nothing I said made any difference. She even threw stones at me. Then neighbors gathered, and they too threw garbage and rocks. They drove me off from the village, calling me a ghost returned to torment them. He broke off, his voice choking, and he gripped the worn wood of the bokken, clenching his fingers until the knuckles whitened. Shea remained silent, watching, her eyes hidden behind her painted mask. After a time, he cleared his throat and continued. I learned afterwards that 4 months had passed. It had been assumed that the leopard had claimed me. There had even been a funeral. I've stood upon my own grave. He studied Shea, his lips quirking drolly. So you see, I am dead, after all. There you are. He sighed then, lifting his shoulders. Having nowhere else to go, I returned to the caves, and there found the ancient waiting for me at his small fire in the dark. I picked up the blade and returned to attempting to defeat him.
And what happened?
Shea asked for the third time, almost inaudibly. He nodded, taking a deep breath to steady himself.
I defeated him.
It took 12 years. 12 years of constant training and dueling under his tutelage. I did not remain hidden in the caverns all that time, of course. I went out for food and to seek company. But all had been warned against the ghost, the living man claimed by death, and so I was driven from every village. Eventually, I would reluctantly return to my harsh tutelage, and in the end I pushed him back and beat him down, or he deemed me skilled enough and allowed me to do so. In any case, of course, it was Hood himself possessing that body, and when I emerged once more into the sunlight, I was his trained sword, the mortal sword of Hood. And so I have been, or was, but no longer. Shea was hugging herself, eyeing him in wonder, though it was difficult to see past her mask.
That is not something one can just put down, I think, like an old coat or a worn blade.
He shrugged again. We shall see. In any case, I no longer answer to him.
Perhaps you do, though. Perhaps you cannot help but follow his path, as it is now part of you.
He sighed, looking away to the distant fires of the camp.
Yes.
It may be that our choices are determined and limited by our character and learned preferences, that is true. However, it is still reassuring to hold on to the conceit of freedom, is it not? Shea smiled beneath her mask and reached out gently with one hand to caress his cheek. Her hand was cold and hard against his face, but welcome.
So it is true, she said. You are not like any other.
Then she took his hand and led him aside to a meadow amid a copse of woods, and there she unbuckled her belt and let it fall into the tall grass, and he did as well. Tentatively then, he reached up to her mask, but gently she lowered his hand, saying,
No, I have chosen to do it.
So she lifted it from her face and stared up at him, bared perhaps for the first time with another. Her eyes were dark in the night, and held his. He lowered his mouth to hers. Tattersall pushed aside the open door to the main keep of the hold and surveyed the damage. Her boots crunched on the litter of broken glass and pots. Mock entered behind her, his hands clasped behind his back, one dark brow arched in silent commentary. A long table had been overturned. Kegs had been broached and left on their sides. Spilt wine stained the flags. Chairs lay every which way, and the stink of old meat and stale beer assailed her. Servants busy cleaning halted in their work and bowed, then returned to their duties. Stooping, she picked up the broken stem of a slim wineglass. They'd even broken her finest crystal.
Who was it? She asked.
Mock gave an unconcerned wave, then tried to pour a glass from a decanter, but found it empty.
The guards say it was Geffen come to try to take the hold.
Send a crew to arrest him and confiscate all he has as payment.
Not necessary, Mock answered, setting down the glass. He's dead.
Who did it?
Mock swept his arms wide.
Does it matter? I hear his lieutenant murdered him and decamped.
He stroked his chin.
A wise woman, that.
A guard wearing the gaudy purple colours of Mock's house guards, what Mock liked to call his palace guards, approached and bowed. Tattersall didn't recognise the fellow.
Hold secure, Admiral.
Mock acknowledged this, then tilted his head thoughtfully.
And where is Commander Dural? Halfway to the Wiccan Plains by now, I should think.
Mock nodded.
And you are?
Egil, sir.
Drew the short straw, did you?
The man just shrugged in his leather hauberk.
Next in command.
Perhaps I should have you thrown into a cell below, Egil.
The guard's thin lips quirked up in a sort of sardonic comment.
You're rather understaffed for that.
Mock nodded sourly, his own expression mirroring the man's.
Painfully true, Commander.
And he dismissed him. After Egil left, kicking through the wreckage as he went, Tattersall whispered,
I don't trust that man.
I trust no one, Mock answered, adding hastily, excepting you, of course.
So what do we do?
He was systematically checking every keg and carafe for leavings.
We wait, love. We wait and see.
See what?
Whether the captains agree on challenging me after this. My bet is that they won't.
Tattersall crossed her arms tightly over her chest.
Good. That's one thing we don't need right now.
Across the hall, one surviving hanging caught her eye. Agela's dark foreboding tapestry. And she winced.
Stupid vandals. Of all the things to leave undamaged.
Then she shrugged. Perhaps some aura of that formidable woman imbued it. She knew she certainly didn't want to touch it.
So, they still agree you should be Admiral?
A burst of laughter answered her, and she turned. Mock was shaking his head, a jug in his hand.
You are so very charming, my dear.
He filled at last from the jug, took an experimental sip, made a sour face, and continued drinking regardless.
They all think they can do a better job than I. They just can't agree who should. And they all know I have one thing they do not.
Which is?
The heels of his tall boots crackled over the litter as he approached, and he brushed the back of a hand across her cheek.
You, my dear. They all saw who broke the Napan lines and who allowed them to escape. You, my dear.
He opened his arms wide, jug in one hand, glass in the other, winking.
I will check upstairs, love. I just pray no one vomited there.
Watching him go, Tattersall shook her head.
Such a rogue.
Footsteps at the entrance brought her round. A woman was standing in the threshold, peering about the reception hall. Tattersall had never seen her before, and from her plain homespun shirt and trousers and dirty bare feet, she thought her a servitor come to ask for work in the kitchens. She drew breath to shoo her out of the keep, but in that instant she felt the woman's full presence, and the weight and power of her aura nearly thrust her back.
Ye gods, who is this?
Tattersall's hands jerked to raise her warren as the woman came forward, kicking unconcerned through broken glass. One hand instead went to her throat and clutched there as her breath would not come.
Who are you?
She managed, shakily. The woman was short, like her, but willow-thin. Her features were odd, perhaps of a people unknown to Tattersall. The face long, and the eyes large. The mouth lipless.
Call me Nightchill,
she answered.
What do you want? You.
Tattersall clutched even tighter at her neck. She gasped.
Why? To meet you. I sensed your performance. It was impressive.
The terrifying power of this woman's aura, the most potent she had ever sensed, far greater than the glimpses she had had of Agela's, made Tattersall want to faint, but she dragged her hand from her throat and nodded, acknowledging the compliment, whispering,
"Well, thank you."
"And to tell you that you are wasted here." Now Tattersall frowned.
"Did Agela send you?"
An entirely humorless smile drew up one edge of the woman's slash of a mouth.
"No, Agela did not send me. I'm here to do you this one favor and to warn you. There are powers circling this island that you are not ready for, child. They will annihilate you. Leave while you can."
Now Tattersall found her teeth clenching and her legs steadying.
"This again. I can take care of myself, and I'll leave when I damn well choose."
The woman shrugged, untroubled.
"Very well. It is your choice. Do not say I did not warn you, however."
And she tipped her head in farewell and walked away. Tattersall's gaze went to the midnight hanging once more and narrowed there.
Damn her meddling.
Then her brows clenched and she stared anew.
Was that ugly portrait of the hold even darker with swirling shadows now?
Nadurian stood at Malaz's harbour wharf and watched the beaten and bedraggled fleet of freebooters and would-be raiders come straggling in. Mox Insufferable had been among the first, looking damaged from the engagement but still seaworthy. The Intolerant and the Intemperate were missing, apparently casualties of the engagement. So too were so many of the freebooter fleet. More were limping in even as he watched, but it appeared as if fully half the assembled flotilla had failed to escape the ambush. King Tarol had struck his piratical rivals a severe blow. It was the talk of the waterfront, of course. The Napan betrayal. And thinking of his employers, Nadurian was worried. The townsfolk might want blood. He pushed away from the wooden crates he was leaning against and headed to the row of waterfront dives that included the Hanged Man and Smiley's. He found the Napan crew closing up shop, even though it was the evening, the best time for their trade. A small two-wheeled cart stood at the door. In it lay the body of Amos, wrapped in canvas sailcloth and sewn tight.
"Come with us," Surly said, sounding tired.
Tukaras helped her up onto the cart, where she sat cradling her side with one arm. Urko took up two poles of the cart and started pulling, and the rest of the Napans followed along. It was to be a burial, obviously, and Nadurian didn't know whether to be honored or resentful at being included. Honored, as the only non-Napan present, resentful because perhaps he wasn't trusted enough to be left behind. Urko led them south to the very tip of the waterfront, where fishers pulled their tiny dories and dugouts from the surf. Coins changed hands with one such fellow, and Urko gently carried the wrapped body to a dory and laid it within. Surly waved Nadurian to join them. He sat at the bow, wrapped in a blanket against the unusual chill of the night. A lantern next to him lit the waves, and the five Napans, Surly, Shrift, and Tukaras at the canvas-wrapped body, Urko and Grinner at the oars. Once they were far out beyond the harbour, Surly and lean Tukaras lifted the body to the gunwale. Surly said a few words in benediction, or farewell, and together they let slip the corpse into the dark water and watched it sink from sight. After a long silence, empty but for the slap of waves and the far-off crash of the surf into the cliffs north of the city, Urko and Shrift began to power the small dory back to the glow of the distant lanterns of Malaz Harbour. Nadurian addressed Tukaras.
"So, a burial at sea."
The tall, pole-slim fellow nodded somberly.
"Yes. Always a sea burial for us Napans. It's a tradition."
And he added, more softly,
"But not for me."
"No?"
"No."
"May I ask why not?" Looking out across the dark waters, the fellow grimaced as if in distaste.
"I hate it. The sea. It's taken too many from me."
Nadurian thought of so many of his old friends, gone now, and he nodded.
"I can understand that."
No more was said until they returned to Smiley's. Nadurian, Surly, and Urko took up posts to keep watch. The mage sat at one of the narrow windows, an eye on the gleaming cobbles of the nighttime street. Urko sat at the door, while Surly busied herself at the bar. A large fire cast an uneven amber glow over the common room. Nadurian sipped his watered wine. He glanced about the quiet room, asked,
"What about your local hires? Where are they?"
"They'll drag their sorry asses back once they've run out of coin," Surly said, from behind the scarred wooden counter.
"And what about you lot?"
he asked Urko, who sat on a tall stool, with his hands and chin resting atop a short hardwood staff before him. His coarse features drew down in a scowl.
"What about us?"
"Why are you still here? Why not leave? You heard how King Tarl betrayed the fleet. Mok might order you arrested."
Urko snorted his derision.
"He can try.
What I mean is, wouldn't it be safer to head to the mainland, hire out as crew?"
The giant fellow's gaze slid to Surly, his wide, knotted hands clenched on the staff.
"Can't. We're..."
"That's enough," Surly cut in.
Her eyes were on Nadurian now, suspicious.
"You're asking a lot of questions."
He raised his hands, open in surrender.
"You're right. Never mind. None of my business. But I'll let you know. I really don't care if you're wanted on the mainland."
Urko just eyed Surly, saying nothing.
"We'll leave," Surly added, meditatively cleaning glasses. "When the Twisted returns."
"It's overdue," Nadurian said, then wished he hadn't.
Now Urko lowered his gaze, frowning even more deeply, his hands clenching as he thumped the staff to the hardwood floor. 3 nights later, Jules Solomon, a fisherman out of Marlas City, sat in the dugout that his father had sat in all his life, and set his lines. His lantern wobbled and glowed in the night from its stand at the pointed bow. Satisfied with his lines, he crouched and waited for the lantern to do its work of drawing the curious fish from the dark depths below. During these quiet moments, he would think, and he reflected now that all his life he'd resented that he was still nothing more than a fisher, like his father before him, while others, friends and cousins, had joined the raiders and become crew on Marlazan freebooters. That is, until this latest disastrous raid, what with near half the crews failing to return. Only now was he beginning to see the wisdom in his father's words, and his demands that he follow in his footsteps and remain a fisher. Perhaps he hadn't been such a bitter, mean, stubborn, worthless old fool after all. As to his father's other claims and wild talk, well, some things were just too foolish to believe. That these raiders and pirates were just recent arrivals to the island, and that its true occupants were the fisher folk themselves. Jule could only shake his head. What of it, if it were true? And that the island's true guardian and protector was a common fisher, just like them. He reached out and jiggled one of the lines. Nothing more than wishful thinking, ridiculous old local legends and stories. That hook, as the saying goes, was just too big to swallow. It was then, in his musings, that he glimpsed a strange glow approaching from the south. Squinting, he sat up and stared, studying the eerie phenomenon. A patch of night glow, as can sometimes gyre atop the waves. A gathering of the bright deep water fish. Or, and here the hair upon his neck stirred and prickled, the demon storm riders come to claim his spirit. The glow thickened into a patch of mist and fog that closed upon him, and now, amid this freezing witch gust of air, there emerged the tall prow of a vessel. Jul gaped up as it passed, a caravel, great tendrils and scarves of mist boiling from its hull, its sails hanging in torn ribbons, great sheaths of ice crackling and carving from its sides as it came. And there, in spidery silver upon its black hull as it loomed past, he read, emblazoned, the name Twisted. Jul fell back into his dugout as it rocked gently from the ghostly passage.
By the gods! The cursed witch vessel itself! Everyone said it had sunk, yet here it was, spat up from the very floor of the abyss.
returned from the sunken paths of Roos, cursed from who knew what fiendish rendezvous, perhaps a pact with the riders themselves. He shivered anew in the unearthly wind blowing off the demon vessel as he yanked up his lines. This tale would win him an entire night of free drinks at the Hanged Man. What a dreadful portent! The twist had returned from its presumed end. He shook his head as he readied the oars. Escaped the ambush after all. Well, who would even dare attack it anyway? Dreadful times were coming, with the return of such a harbinger for sure. Chapter 14 Koro alighted on the blunt stone tip of a standing menhir and cocked his head, regarding with his black beady eyes the surrounding rocky dunes of what some named the Plains of Waste. Idly, he preened the bedraggled fur of his body and wondered anew what to do about these damned pesky meddlers in shadow. If Edgewalker refused to act, the obdurate fool, then it must fall to him. Yet, how to be rid of them? Had Koro still held human form, he would have tapped his chin with a finger. But as it was, he pecked at the gritty ancient stone of the menhir, then squawked and flapped his membranous wings in alarm as a spark of power glowed to silver life and began rolling a turning route down the outside of the carved stone. He alighted again, watching, intrigued, while the quicksilver flash spiraled like a bead of mercury down a curved runnel hacked in the face of the stone. Glyphs of power glowed to life as it descended. Close to the base, the bead of silver was now a blazing fist of power spinning with dizzying speed. Koro squawked anew, losing his perch as the ball of sizzling might smashed into something at the base of the stone. Alighting once more, he turned first one black bead of an eye to the spot, then the other. A heap of wind-blown sand there was shifting, and a groan reached him. A chitinous armored head and shoulders emerged, shaking off the sands. Koro now knew where he perched, and he looked at the pewter sky. Oh, him.
"Where am I?"
the unfortunate below asked aloud.
"You are imprisoned,"
Koro answered. The alien angles of the demon's armored head lowered as it considered its buried torso.
"This I see. I want to get rid of two meddling troublemakers,"
Koro continued.
"Have you any ideas?"
"Troublemakers?"
the entity echoed, sounding confused.
"What, pray tell, do you mean by that?"
"Oh, shut up!"
Koro hissed, shifting from foot to foot.
"I once was powerful,"
the demon murmured, as if groping after something.
"I once was someone."
Koro rolled his pebble eyes to the sky once more.
"Oh, please! Well, now you're an imprisoned nobody."
Then he jumped, his tattered wings half flapping, and he opened his beak in silent laughter.
"Of course."
"Do you know my name?"
the creature below asked, almost plaintively.
"Shut up, fool. I'm having an inspiration."
"I think you know my name,"
the demon continued stubbornly. Koro cursed, pecked the stone, then jumped into the air.
"Fool!"
A spark of silver glowed to life atop the menhir.
"I will remember you,"
the demon howled after him.
"No, you won't."
And he cawed his harsh laughter as he went. The meager fire cast further shifting shadows across the tall, crumbling walls of the gulch surrounding them, and standing in the darkness, Dancer wondered on the wisdom of such an extravagance. He glanced back to the fire, and the dark figure hunched there, staring into its depths, chin resting atop his walking stick. Clenching his teeth, he returned to stare down at Kellenved. After a moment, he let out a long-suffering breath and said once more, "We really should return." The wizened, black-skinned mage did not answer. He kept his gaze firm upon the fire. Willfully so, it seemed to Dancer, who cleared his throat again.
"They'll catch us eventually. You must know this."
The hunched Dolhon shrugged, unconcerned.
"I will shift us again,"
There were four last time.
I can now stay ahead of them.
Dancer drew a quick breath, fought down his anger, and grated,
For the moment, but eventually...
The little man's shoulders clenched higher, and his lips tightened stubbornly. Sighing, Dancer looked away to the weak, shifting shadows.
What is this thing you're trying to sense, anyway? The node, the young mage, who still appeared an ancient, exploded. The locus! The heart!
Dancer eyed the surrounding slopes and eased the blades in their sheaths about his chest, thighs, and neck.
And what does all that rubbish mean in plain language?
The little man flapped his hands in mute frustration. Finally, he slammed his stick into the sands.
You have heard, I hope, of the Throne of Night.
Yes, in songs and legends.
Well, exactly,
the mage announced, as if it were all common sense.
Exactly what?
The Dolhon spluttered, flapping his hands.
Well, light and night had thrones, yes?
Dancer nodded. So they say.
Well, so too must shadow then.
Dancer drew a blade, a razor stiletto, and thumbed its edge.
I understand that's all more poetry than history.
Kellenved examined his ebony walking stick, huffing.
Well, yes. However, each must possess some centre of power, some locus. Call it what you will. Control that, and one controls the entire realm.
Dancer pushed the blade home into the sheath at his left wrist, nodded thoughtfully.
Our path is disputed.
Kellenved now tapped his fingers upon the silver hound's head of the walking stick.
Yes. Well, an inconvenience. Once we have...
Dancer raised a finger.
No. They must be handled first, and we cannot do that while on the run.
Kellenved set his chin atop the stick, as if pouting, and stared into the guttering fire. After a time, he sighed resentfully.
Oh, very well.
Dancer eased his shoulders, and the joints cracked with the strain of his tension. Inwardly, he allowed himself a satisfied nod.
Very good.
He sat across the fire to rest.
You will keep watch?
The mage nodded.
Yes, I will keep watch.
The next day, if the slight brightening of the monochromatic grey of shadow could be called day, Dancer became aware of the dot in the sky of the strange flying creature, which, from time to time, seemed to have been trailing them.
It's back, he announced to Kellenved, who merely waved his stick, unimpressed.
This time, however, the shape flapped ever closer, becoming ever larger, until it plopped down ahead of them in a very ungainly fashion, raising dust as it paced about. Dancer thought it an ugly cross between a bat and a pelican. Kellenved, for his part, stopped before it and rested his hands atop his walking stick. Then he actually addressed it, saying invitingly,
Yes?
To Dancer's surprise and profound unease, the creature drew itself up almost haughtily and called,
Welcome to Shadow!
Kellenved merely nodded, as if this were an everyday occurrence.
Our thanks. Welcome, indeed.
The bat thing now cast its tiny, glistening black eyes about the desolate surroundings, then lowered its knife-like head to croak.
I know what it is you seek.
Kellenved glanced to Dancer, his brows raised.
And that is?
The beast actually looked to the sky as if exasperated.
Shadow House, of course.
It bounced from one clawed foot to the other.
Shadow House, you fool!
Now Kellenved shot Dancer a rather bemused look. He gave an exaggerated, knowing nod.
Ah, Shadow House, of course.
The creature calmed, bobbing its hatchet head.
I will take you.
Why?
Dancer demanded. The beast squawked, flapping its ragged wings of black skin.
What? Why? I offer you the realm and you ask why?
Kellenved stilled.
The realm, you say?
Why?
Dancer asked again, his voice now hard. He glanced about, wondering whether this was a delaying tactic. Were enemies closing upon them even now?
Tell me more about the realm, Kellenved invited.
Why? Dancer repeated, firmly, eyeing the horizons. Kellenved sighed, his shoulders slumping.
Very well. Why?
The beast's gaze shifted right to left.
Ah, well.
It rubbed its wings together and lowered its head even further.
There are secrets within. Secrets that you must share with me.
Kellenved turned to Dancer.
There you are. Secrets.
He pointed his walking stick ahead.
Do lead on.
The creature bounced into the air, laughing a bird-like croak as it went.
This way!
Kellenved strolled onward. Dancer pressed a hand to his forehead, then reluctantly followed.
I don't like it, he complained.
The Dolhon mage waved the stick about to indicate the leagues of empty rocky hillsides.
Which of our many options would you prefer, then?
Dancer gritted his teeth.
Fine. We investigate, then leave. Yes?
Ahead, Kellenved nodded absently, already humming to himself. They travelled for what seemed to Dancer to be far too long. Eventually the hounds would arrive, as they always did, and he saw no likely cave or retreat anywhere within reach. Once more they were gambling on Kellenved's being able to shift them elsewhere, and Dancer did not like it. One failure, and that would be it. Ahead, a dark line appeared to be nearing, some sort of break in the monotonous rocky desert landscape of this region of shadow. Dancer was now leading Kellenved, who limped, wincing in his tattered shoes, and so he paused, gesturing ahead.
Our destination?
Kellenved came alongside, winded and sweating. He shaded his gaze.
Very possibly. There is something there. I sense...
He trailed off, as above the dark shape of their guide was now stooping towards them, its thin wings flapping furiously. As it passed overhead, it squawked,
Run!
Dancer caught his companion's eye.
Shit!
They both ran. Dancer, however, soon pulled ahead of the limping, huffing mage, and so he halted, kicking up dust and stones, cursing. He drew his heaviest blades, searched the hillsides behind for signs of movement.
Quiet this time. Getting smarter. Hurry!
He snapped at Kellenved, who'd halted with him.
If I'd known we'd be tramping all over, I'd have worn different shoes, I assure you.
Just run!
Dancer snapped, impatient. But the mage merely shook his head, gesturing ahead, panting. Reluctant, dreading what he knew he'd see, Dancer slowly turned about. Ahead, two shapes, fully as large as colts, had risen from among the rocks, each shaking sand from its back. One bore savage scars across its black muzzle, while the other's mismatched eyes blazed yellow and blue.
Hunting as a pack, should have known.
He raised his twinned heavy parrying goshes while turning full circle. From each direction, a hound now closed. He counted five.
Driven? Can we have been driven like rabbits into this ambush? Get us out of here,
he mouthed to Kellenved. Overhead, their erstwhile guide had taken off, flying like an arrow for the dark line far off on the horizon. And Dancer wondered, could they have been following it? How smart were these things?
How many are there of these beasts, do you imagine? Kellenved asked. Just move us. Yes, yes, no need to be snippy.
Dancer turned another full circle to see that, indeed, the creatures were closing upon them from all sides. They were not of one singular hue, being tawny or earthen brown or mottled grey and black. Yet they were certainly alike in their titanic size and the strange lustre or luminosity of their eyes. They stalked forward now, low on their forepaws, ears down, lips pulled back from canines the length of his fingers. Their low hunting growl shook the ground beneath his feet and vibrated in his chest.
Now would be good, he murmured to his companion.
But Kellenved did not have to respond. Tatters of darkness flitted across Dancer's vision, deepening and thickening like sifting shadows, until he could see only dense murk, like a midnight underwater vision of the world. A blasting howl of lustful frustration made him flinch, and then he hit the ground hard and rolled in dust. He came up with weapons raised, circling, but they were alone. Kellenved sat hunched in the dust nearby. He appeared to be examining his feet. A forest's edge rose some leagues distant. Their destination, Dancer assumed.
Run! He said.
The mage gestured to the flapping leather remnants of his shoes.
I really do have a complaint for that cobbler.
Ignore them! Just run!
I can't!
A hound's deep, rich baying sounded from the distance, closing. Dancer yanked him to his feet, and they ran, awkwardly, Kellenved hopping as he pulled at the tattered strips tied about his feet. Dancer searched the edge for some path or route into the thick woods, but none was visible. So he headed straight for the nearest verge and ploughed in, pushing aside dry black branches, his feet sinking into a deep loose layer of rotting leaves and bracken. Only after pushing onward for some time, yanking Kellenved firmly along, did he pause, listening. He could hear the beasts howling still, but it sounded strangely distant, muted somehow. A rustling in the branches above caused him to snatch up his throwing daggers. It was the black bat-like thing hopping among the higher boughs.
You see?
It croaked, triumphant.
They are not following,
Kellenved observed, and he frowned in distaste at his bare feet.
Why are they not following?
The bat thing cocked its head. Its black pebble eyes peered about.
Well, they are forbidden. Yes, they are forbidden from entering the forest.
Why?
Koro hopped from foot to foot in frustration.
Because they are! Because of the house! Yes, the house is near!
Dancer peered into the tangled depths of the woods.
How near?
Near!
The creature flapped into the air, calling,
This way!
Kellenved was gingerly testing his feet on the cluttered ground.
Perhaps you could...
No, I couldn't,
Dancer cut in, heading off to follow the beast.
Just for a short while.
No.
Until we reach the house.
No.
You're not being cooperative at all,
the mage grumbled.
I did not buy cheap shoes,
Kellenved harrumphed.
They were not cheap, I tell you that.
All the more reason.
Could you two possibly shut up?
Came a call from above. Both Dancer and Kellenved peered upwards, blinking. Koro was above, bobbing its sharp, knife-like head.
I'm trying to listen.
Dancer stilled, listening as well.
For what?
Kellenved asked, and Dancer shot him a glare. Each of the creature's wide, membranous wings held a tiny, clawed hand, and the beast pressed one now to its edged beak, hissing,
Shh!
Dancer listened, motionless. He heard only the creaking of the countless trees about them. Kellenved cleared his throat.
Ah! There's something quiet. Something's got my...
Dancer turned on him.
Will you be quiet?
The mage pointed to his feet, hidden in the deep loam.
Something's grabbed my foot.
Dancer cursed. He moved to draw a blade, but found he couldn't. A vine had tightened itself about his forearm.
What in the name of...
Kellenred was suddenly yanked down into the loam up to his knees. Yet he did not appear panicked, only embarrassed. He observed,
Well, this is depressingly familiar.
Dancer tried to reach a blade with his other hand, but found it too bound by vines. They pulled, yanking him tight up against a nearby tree trunk. Above, the creature cawed its harsh laugh.
Here they come! Your panicked screams!
Are you panicked?
Dancer asked Kellenved. The mage threw his walking stick at the beast, missing widely.
Not yet.
The creature paced back and forth on its high branch.
Well, they're coming, I assure you. Once you find yourself...
The bat thing now hung upside down, swinging wildly, one foot caught up by a vine.
Help! It has me! Look what you've done, you fools!
It flapped its wings furiously, pulling and pulling. Then, with a parting snap, the vine broke and the beast ricocheted off, bouncing from tree to tree.
"You will scream,"
it squawked as it flapped away.
"You'll see. Entombed forever. Absorbed. Becoming one with shadow."
Dancer watched it go, then settled his attention upon Kellenved. "So, what now?" The mage was tapping a free hand to his chin. His eyes narrowed.
"Could it really be that simple?"
he mused aloud. Thick, woody limbs now closed upon Dancer's chest, tightening.
"Whatever it is, you'd better hurry!"
A vine yanked Kellenved's hand away, and he was pulled down to his waist.
"An idea," he explained. "All this time I've been trying to force shadow. But perhaps that's wrong. Perhaps I should ease into it, become one with it, as the creature said. Perhaps that's the secret."
Dancer did not answer, as he was holding his breath in outward pressure against the crushing embrace of the branches. He simply jerked a nod and fumed that he could no longer even curse the pontificating fool. The mage was nodding as he slipped to his chest among the rotting leaves.
"Very well. I will give it a try, though it will be difficult, and we are far from Marla's."
Dancer smiled a rictus of encouragement, his lips clenched.
"So, here goes,"
the mage said, as his head disappeared down beneath the loamy, steaming surface. His vision darkening, Dancer looked to the pewter grey sky through the closing branches.
"Well, so much for that."
The limbs tightened, crushing his chest, and his breath burst from him. He fought to inhale again and again, until nothingness took him. The day of his execution, Taishren wore the clean linen shirt and trousers provided for him. Stubble now roughened his skull and chin, and though he'd no polished bronze or silver mirror to see in, he knew he'd lost weight and must appear rather haggard. As anyone who'd spent weeks contemplating one's imminent execution would, especially when a fresh cup of poison is provided alongside each day's portion of water. That day, two of the cult fangs appeared at his cell as escort. When the thick wooden door was pulled open, they'd seemed a touch surprised to find him within and still alive. In the past, many so sentenced had preferred to take their own life rather than face the horror to come, which was precisely why the priesthood had allowed him to sit so long in solitary reflection on that poison, and which was precisely why he refused the option. No convenient hidden disappearance that could easily be swept aside and forgotten for him. No. He would go out in full public display and do his best to rub their faces in it. And so he rose from his meditation, dressed in the clean new clothes, and exited calmly and quietly. One factor did penetrate his calm, however. It was plain from his cell window that it was the dead of night. As he walked the empty halls, the uneasy suspicion came to him that perhaps they intended to throw him into the pits unannounced, in the dark, without any witnesses. The way one might dispose of an embarrassing piece of evidence. High Priestess Saline, after all, hadn't announced the exact time of his execution. Just the sort of oily bureaucratic solution a career functionary might favour. The suspicion wormed through the wall of calm he'd so carefully built between his fears and his reason, and caused him to check his pace. What, then? One of the fangs urged him onward, and he resumed pacing, thinking, well, if they go that far, then perhaps I need not cooperate after all. His fears, however, were put to rest when he was delivered to a holding cell at the civic pit. Here he knew he would sit and wait while the crowd gathered above. It now looked like a noon execution. The morning's light grew slanting down in dust-filled rays from high, narrow windows. The day's heat reached his cell. The muted din of conversation slowly swelled. It sounded like a packed crowd. Then came a quiet knock at his door, and he cocked a brow. Really? A polite knock?
Yes.
A fang of Derek opened the door from without, and a white-robed acolyte entered. She held in both hands a small earthenware cup full of a thick, dark liquid. Taishren knew this. Derek's mercy, a numbing potion that would dull the pain to come. Unfortunately, it also numbed the mind. The young woman held out the cup, her head lowered. He shook his head, then to his surprise found that he had to swallow to speak, and murmured,
"No."
She bowed lower, saying,
"This is not about bravery, Taishren."
"I do not wish to go to Derek with a clouded mind."
The acolyte nodded.
"I understand."
She withdrew to the door, but paused there, trembling almost.
"I am sorry, Taishren. Not all agree with this."
He frowned at her. Agree with what? His execution? Tallow's rise? One of the fangs guarding the cell grabbed her arm and pulled her out, slamming the door shut. He sat in silence, frowning still. Had there been a faction looking to him after all? Had he, in his inaction, let them down? Yet he had not asked for any of this, nor did he want it. So he sat, while above, roars and cheering came and went for the preliminary executions, petty criminals, minor cult offenders and the like, until a single voice, rendered unintelligible by the yards of stone between, spoke at length. They were announcing him, listing his supposed crimes. Sure enough, the door opened, and the two fangs of Derek gestured him out. Rising, he was surprised again by how dry his mouth was, and the heat and sweat of his hands. Just the flesh, he reminded himself, dreading impending dissolution. That is all. He was led up a narrow passage of dressed stone blocks. Cells lining the way held the condemned, and the stink of human excrement, piss, and stale sweat hung thick in the enclosed space. Taishren merely noted all this in passing, without discomfort. He knew far worse was to come. In the half-light streaming down from a door ahead, he noted messages scrawled upon the faces of the blocks. "Tell Harina I love her. Damn the bitch Selene, and may Derek forgive them." The fang ahead at the door carried a red sash. She waved him closer.
"Turn round,"
she ordered. Feeling oddly dazed, Taishren complied. His hands were taken, and the sash was cinched tight about his wrists. He gave a light snort of appreciation of the gesture. Tallow, it would seem, was not without a poetic side. The iron latch of the door clanged, the heavy stone barrier grated as it swung open, and Taishren was pushed out onto the glaringly bright sands of the civic pit. He stood blinking for a time, unaccustomed to the light, and a huge roar arose from the stands, a punishing thunder of shouts, applause, catcalls, curses, and cheering. Squinting around, he saw that the rising circular rings of the Colosseum were very nearly full to capacity. A good turnout for Selene and Tallow. Dutifully, he walked out towards the center of the broad circular pit. The dry husks of thousands of shed carapaces crackled beneath his sandaled feet as he went. The sunlight blasted down upon him, and he couldn't even bring his hands out from behind his back to shield his gaze. He damned the heat. Already his clothes hung heavy and damp. "Sweating," he noted, distantly and analytically. "I am sweating so much because I am frightened. There, it's been said. I can admit it. The terror of the unknown. In that, at least, I share a commonality with the herd that surrounds me." More or less at the center, he halted and turned to face the main seating platform. In the glare, he couldn't make out any one individual, just a sea of dark robes. Eventually, the roaring calls and jeers died down enough for a single voice to surface above the sullen grumbling.
"Taishren,"
the voice called. "High Priestess Selene." He raised his chin with what he hoped signaled defiance and pride. Yet he was panting, his pulse racing in that damned unavoidable fleshly weakness. "Deep breaths," he chided himself.
"Your crimes against the integrity of the cult have been enumerated and suitable punishment has been writ. You have been found guilty of putting your own benefit and selfish desires ahead of the good of the faith of Derek. Have you any last words before judgment is enacted?
Strange, he noted, standing before them, blinking, how power-hungry people tend to charge their opponents with the very sins that apply to them. He opened his mouth to speak, but found he had no breath for speech. The sun's glare was making his eyes water. Why else would wetness be cold on his cheeks? And the tightness in his chest, choking off speech, appalled outrage, surely.
No? Nothing? Selene prompted. Not even an appeal to Derek for forgiveness?
This announcement stung Teshren like nothing else in the entire charade of the trial. The cowardly sentencing, and now this farcical perversion of mercy.
Forgiveness!
He shouted, hoarse, his voice near cracking.
You are the ones who will beg for forgiveness!
But Selene has signaled the drummers, and now their blasting cacophony robbed him of any hope of being heard. Nonetheless, the dark bulk next to Selene that was Tallow seemed to stir at his words, perhaps uneasy, perhaps worried that he would lash out now at the end. But he would give them no such satisfaction. He would meet Derek with more dignity and courage than any they could ever muster, though it annoyed him how his eyes did sting and water in the glare, and he could not wipe them. So he turned his back upon them to await the end. The thunder of the drums shook the sands beneath his feet, vibrating the ground, calling the denizens below. And there, in the dark caverns and tunnels, he knew they stirred, rising, heeding the summons. Soon they would be upon him, seething, pricking, filling his mouth and nose until he choked. He blinked savagely, weaving upon his feet, suddenly unsteady. The heat, he decided, must be this damned heat. The hissing of the horde's arrival assaulted him then, louder, it seemed, even than the drums, all about him, closing. He blinked the tears from his eyes, fought the rabid urge to flee. No, he thought to himself, wait. A tickling wave of thousands surged across his feet like a surf. Countless proboscis probed his flesh. A million feet climbed his ankles. Wait, no, this is not, I want to. A rising numbness in his feet and legs now made it difficult to stand. He fell to his knees, or thought he did. Was this tide of vermin rising upon him, or was he sinking into it? He could no longer tell. The numbness took his chest, and for this he was thankful, as a writhing layer of creatures now blanketed his clamped mouth and closed eyes. But he could not seal his nostrils, and they entered there, the tiny silverfish and the smallest of the flesh-eating maggots. Then his breath exploded from him in a convulsive gasp, and they foamed into his open mouth as he inhaled. He gagged and gagged, rolling and vomiting even as he fought to inhale. But no breath could breach the sea of writhing creatures choking him. He screamed mutely in an abhorrence and revulsion beyond any his mind could grasp. And thankfully, it gave up. Darkness descended. Though the civic pit lay far across the city, Scylla could still hear the muted, distant roar of the gathered crowd. Even in this court overlooking the sea from a far side chapel of the temple, even here she could not escape it. As if she ever would for the rest of her life. She wrung her cold hands together, pacing. Why was the fool still here? Wasn't enough enough? Must he go to the end to prove his point? That thought froze her in her pacing. Of course he would. He was right. He knew he was right. And he would go to the end to prove it. But Tallow had promised her it would never come to this, that he would send him away to a new life on the mainland. The Invigilator! She grasped the stone lip of the ledge overlooking the sea. Damn the man! Nothing but lies! She stilled, watching the dizzying glimmer of the waves far below. But that wasn't true. He hadn't lied.
He'd showed her concocted evidence and testimony that he could have used to condemn Taishren to the death of the Fang that very day in court. Only her cooperation had saved his life. Only her testimony saved him from the poison that day. Only today. She jumped then, as the reverberation of the drums struck her. He's still there. Why? Why won't he flee? She pressed her fists to her mouth. Damn him! Damn the stubborn fool! Would he really be that willfully determined? To go to his death rather than yield to anyone? She nodded then, a fist at her mouth, and sighed. Yes. Yes, he would. The distant commingled awe and delight of thousands now swelled, and she clutched at the ledge for support. Great Derek! He's being taken! Taken! And all because of her. No, she saved him. Saved his life that day. And Tallow assured her it wouldn't come to this. Tallow. She straightened then, her breath easing from her in a hiss. From inside her robes, she drew a small sheathed dagger and examined the wax seal at the lip of the bronze sheath. This she had meant for herself. But another had earned its kiss far more than she. She would play the part of the beaten-down disciple for now, until the moment came. Then he would pay for his lies.
He will pay.
She pushed the sheath blade back down within her robes, wiped the wetness from her face, and slipped back within the temple precincts.
Chapter 15. Carthoron stood with Choss and Hall on board the Twisted, awaiting Surly. It had been nearly a week since they'd limped into Marlas Harbour, and now their commander wanted a detailed appraisal of the ship's condition. The news was grim, and Surly, he knew, would not be happy. He watched from the railing as she marched out onto the pier, accompanied by Urko, Shrift, and 10 or so local Marlazan toughs, her bodyguard, now that they'd hardened their control of the majority of the island's black market. Also trailing along was this new follower, Nadurian, old and scarred, in plain travel-stained leathers, looking more like a retired fisherman than a veteran mage. Carthoron had to say that he wasn't certain he trusted the fellow yet. The toughs remained at the gangway, while Surly, Urko, Shrift, and the mage came stamping up. On deck, she crossed her arms and faced him. Her habitual sour expression demanded, "Well?" He noticed she favoured her side, where he understood Geffen had cut her quite badly before she broke his neck. Local healers had done their work, but these things still smarted, he knew. Carthoron cleared his throat, glanced to Choss and Hall. Might as well jump into the depths, he reasoned. "We recommend laying up the entire winter season for a proper refit." That he'd said the wrong thing was immediately evident in her flat, side-to-side denial.
"Not what I want to hear, Crust. I want off this island."
"We need the time," Choss put in. "We struck two ice floes."
"Doesn't matter. I don't want to be here all winter." "She won't be ready," Hall said.
Shrift now waved her impatience, butting in.
"What's the problem? We just take another."
She motioned all about.
"There are plenty."
"Not like this one," Nadurian drawled from where he leaned against the railing outside their circle.
Shrift turned a sneer on the man. For some unknown reason, the swordswoman had no time for the mage.
"Oh? How so?"
By way of answer, the fellow rested his lazy gaze on Hall.
"Because she's ensorcelled. Isn't that so, Hall?"
Hall eyed him in turn, then nodded.
"Aye."
"No other vessel could have made it out of the strait," the mage continued. "Isn't that true?"
"Possibly," Hall granted.
Carthoron was thinking of the just cause. They'd lost sight of it soon after entering the Strait of Storms, and after that, they'd all been too busy fighting the ice build-up and evading the floes to consider its fate. But he still couldn't let go of his worry. What if it had made it after all? Wouldn't it be prudent?
He cleared his throat again, saying, "Surly might be right. Perhaps we should push off as soon as possible, finish the repairs elsewhere."
"And just where?"
Hall answered, exasperated. "We can't show our faces anywhere on the mainland."
"Kartul?"
Chos offered. Shrift shuddered, and Urko's blunt face twisted in disgust.
"God, no,"
he rumbled. "Further afield," Surly said, crossing her arms. "We offer our services to one of the seven holy cities, Aran or Ubarid."
"Got no navvies worth the name,"
Urko offered, nodding and scratching his chin.
"We'd be facing the Falari," Hall warned.
Urko waved one great paw in dismissal.
"Pah, we can take them."
But Surly would not move her steady gaze from Carthoron. He tapped his fingers on the scarred railing.
"Heard troubling things about that sea cult of theirs. What is it? The Gistel? Blood sacrifices."
Surly's gaze did not waver.
"We'll face that when we must. But right now we've hung about too long."
Carthoron nodded his agreement. Yes. By now, Tarel must know they were here, word from the Just Cause or not. He already seemed to have the island in his sights.
"Yes," he agreed, reluctantly. "Minimal repairs. Just enough to get us to seven cities."
Chos snorted, commenting under his breath,
"That's some journey, I'll have you know."
"Regardless," Surly said, and she uncrossed her arms. "How long?" she asked Chos.
Their best boat right twisted up his features, thinking.
2 moons, soonest.
"One."
The man jerked his head, as if pained.
"What?"
"One," she warned, pointing. "We're done. Everyone help out on the repairs."
And she turned and headed down the gangway, followed by Urko, Shrift, and the new mage. Chos leaned against the railing and looked to Carthoron, shaking his head.
"Plenty of work ahead for all of us. So, where's your new guy, Dujek, and his tag-along?"
"Out whipping our Marlazan boys and girls into shape."
Chos raised his chin to the pier.
"What do you think of the new mage?"
Carthoron considered, lifted his shoulders.
"Looks like a veteran."
"He is,"
Hall said from behind. Carthoron turned to her. She was eyeing the retreating figures.
"He has ex-legionnaire written all over him."
"Ex-legionnaire?" Carthoron echoed.
"As in the Talian Iron Legions,"
he whistled.
"We could use him."
"If we can trust him."
"Trust him? What do you mean?"
But the heavy mage simply hugged her broad chest and tilted her head in thought.
"Don't know. Got a funny feeling on the ship just then with everyone. Keep an eye on him, Crust."
Carthoron nodded his full agreement.
"If you say so, Hall."
The caravan was encamped a day's journey from Fidal, a southern Itko Khan city, and termination point of the main north-south overland trade route. At the sprawling caravanserai grounds, a broad meadow of trampled grass, fires were lit against the dark and animals were being brushed, fed and cared for. As was usual, Darsem went for a long walk through the night. This time, however, he was alone. Shea no longer even spoke to him, save to lower her masthead to him in passing, as if she were his subordinate, which he knew she now believed herself to be. It was autumn. The grass was dry and brittle and snagged at his trousers. There was an early chill to the air. He'd overheard some merchants attribute this to the sea of storms just to their south. He paused in the dark to look skyward. Old familiar stars glowed above the southern horizon. The constellations of his youth, the spear, the cart, the sky mother. Tomorrow they would part. He would carry on to the coast to take a ship out to Marla's island, which he'd heard described uninvitingly as cold, rainy, and dreary. While she, he understood, would return to her island home, far away. He ran a hand through the tall, sharp-edged grasses. Should he simply allow that to happen? Shouldn't he return, ask her to accompany him and Nara? Why not? After standing silent for a time, he let out a long, slow breath. No. Hood had not taken his eye from him. He was certain of that. The Grey Walker held some special fate in store for him. Some stern lesson for his defiance. He would not embroil her in that. Yet, shouldn't that be her choice? He could warn her of the dangers and let her choose. He half turned back to the distant flickering fires of the encampment, then quickly sank to his haunches amid the tall, sighing grasses. Weapon oil and sweat. Then the brush of ringmail and the faint click of a crossbow setting. He reached down to his waist only to remember that he'd left his sword behind. And is Hood laughing now? Mortal sword indeed. Ha! He lay still, listening. From what he could piece together, it sounded as if a wide, staggered picket line just passed his position, closing on the caravanserai. Crouched still, he padded along behind the nearest of the individuals. To his benefit, it was a dark night, and none of the figures carried any source of light, no doubt being guided by the fires of the camp. He took the man from the rear, clamped his hands round his neck just long enough for unconsciousness, then lowered him into the grasses. What he found, a ragged, patched hauberk over a stained old Carnian uniform, confirmed his suspicion. Outlaws, or renegades. Through this gap in the picket, he hurried inward, still crouched for a time, and jogged for camp. The main body of the outlaws entered the caravanserai even as he closed. Panicked shouts arose, but thankfully no screams or clash of blades. Yet. He pushed through the milling families and groggy, fretful merchants to a position across a fire from where Shear stood with Horst Grethel. The fat-bellied caravan master had his arms in the air and was shouting for calm. Shear, of course, spotted him amid the flickering shadows. In the firelight, her mask seemed to swim with a kaleidoscope of rich colours. Her blade was not drawn, as yet. A hand, low at her side, gave a slight, flat wave. Wait.
No need for any violence, Lul, Horst was saying to one of the outlaws. You'll have your payment.
Tithe, the man clarified, rather archly. He wore a faded officer's surcoat over a hauberk of scale. He was bearded, and his hair was long and bedraggled, suggesting he'd been camping in the field for a great many months.
Our legal due for keeping the roads safe here, so close to the Dol Hon border. Safe from whom? Horst grumbled under his breath.
The former officer chose magnanimously to ignore the complaint. He gestured to his men and women, all probably his own troops, and they set to searching the wagons. Darsem's hands clenched as bolts of cloth, blankets, baskets, and cooking utensils came crashing out of the wagons amid protests and shouts.
You're searching all the wagons and carts, he called to the retired, or cashiered, officer.
Lul turned his way, searching the dim firelight.
All must contribute to the tithe,
he squinted, frowning.
And you are...
Darsem started for his cart.
Stop that man, Lul bellowed.
Darsem threw down a number of the outlaw soldiers nearby, but had to halt as numerous crossbows were leveled against him. He stood, waiting, while Lul marched up to study him closely. Face to face, Lul said,
You are in an awful hurry to reach your goods, my friend.
Darsem said nothing, fists clenched. His gaze was fixed into the darkness where his cart lay.
Forgot to hide something, perhaps? Some gold or silver, maybe?
Lul looked him up and down.
You don't look wealthy, but perhaps it's all hidden away in your wagon, or among your rags, eh?
Darsem studied the 7 glinting crossbow quarrels arrayed before him, with more behind, no doubt. He damned this man for taking what looked like his entire command with him from the Carnian fold. A bellow arose from the dark, a shout of open terror.
Plague!
Darsem looked to the night sky and mouthed a silent curse. One of the ex-soldiers came running to Lul, pointing a shaking finger back into the darkness.
A cart! He gasped. A girl! Plague!
It's not plague, Darsem announced to everyone.
Lul's gaze narrowed in suspicion.
What's this? You bring a sick family member south with you?
Horst now pushed forward, saying outraged,
You told me she was old and infirm.
She is not sick,
Darsem repeated, stubbornly, but sounding unconvincing even to himself.
I've seen plague, the outlaw told Lul, and she has it.
He slapped his hands to his mouth, saying,
Gods! There must have been sickly vapors in there, and they touched me.
Lul nodded to the fellow.
Burn it.
No!
Darsem lurched forward, then spun as a crossbow bolt gouged his left side, passing on into the darkness. He stilled, hunched in pain, a hand pressed to his side, panting. Lul watched him warily, then waved his man onward.
Go on! Burn it!
Darsem reached out to Horst.
Think, man. How could she be a carrier? Has anyone got sick? Have I?
But the fat caravan master just backed away, shaking his head. The outlaw jogged off. Darsem watched him disappear between the wagons and steeled himself to follow, though it meant a suicidal charge through a hail of crossbow bolts. Even as he tensed for the leap, a great flash erupted from the nearby fire, blinding him and bringing cries of surprise and shock from everyone. A hand took his arm, and he did not fight as he recognized the touch.
This way,
Shear whispered, dragging him along by the elbow. He wiped at his tearing eyes.
What was that? Are you a mage?
No. It is a chemical made by our people north of my homeland. They trade small pinches of it.
That was a pinch?
She pushed him up against the wagon.
Do you begin all your fights unarmed?
Well, it was a spur-of-the-moment thing.
He blinked, repeatedly, struggling to regain his vision.
Lead me to the northernmost part of the clearing.
Shouts and panic now filled the air as the caravan merchants and families sought to flee. Lul's command voice rose over the tumult.
Find them and kill them!
Shear took his arm and thrust a weapon into his hand. He hefted it and was appalled by its balance.
What is this?
She was pulling him along.
A sword. I took it from one of the outlaws.
It is wretched.
So throw it away and request something more suitable.
Shapes moved now in his vision, families dashing about in the dark. Shear moved suddenly, and a body fell to the dirt, writhing and gurgling. He wiped at his face.
My apologies. It is a fine blade.
They hurried onward. He could see almost well enough now to make his own way.
You believe me, then?
He asked, as they threaded between wagons.
This isn't the plague.
If it was the plague, she'd be dead by now. As would you.
Exactly. Then why all this?
Fear is fear. It has no logic.
He could make out the cart. Men and women were gathered there, carrying torches. They'd pulled it clear and were throwing dry wood and brush up against its sides. Despite the searing pain at his side, he clamped both hands onto the weapon, hissing,
Hood, witness!
And charged. Together they cleared the area around the cart very quickly. Then by mutual nods they separated, he going to the left, she the right, and worked their way southward through the caravanserai, slaying every outlaw they met. After the 15th, he began to feel sorry for these common soldiers, renegade or not, and switched to incapacitating cuts across the face, weapon arm, side or neck. Some of these would bleed out, he knew, but others would have the option of limping away. He found Lul in the southwest corner, behind a semicircle of defending crossbowers, double ranked. Some sort of word or battle instinct must have warned him of what was coming, and he was retreating behind his surviving men and women. They were pacing backwards, kneeling, firing into the dark, switching ranks and reloading, all in sequence. Crouched in the grasses, Darsem admired their precision and discipline. Shear joined him, and together they followed, hunched, parting the grass with their blades to study the formation for an opening.
Perhaps we shall have to let them go,
Shear offered.
We have to end this, or they will return.
He peered back towards the camp, thinking.
A moment, he said, and jogged off.
In the camp, he found what he sought. A family of Seti tribal descent, refugees of some feud or blood crime. He approached the aged grandfather guarding their felt-covered cart and nodded a greeting. The man held a wicked recurve bow low before him, an arrow nocked. A tall spear adorned with wolf tails leaned up against the cart next to him. Darsem motioned to the weapon.
"May I borrow your fine spear?"
The fellow reached over and held it out.
"An honor, sword of death."
Darsem shook his head.
"No longer.
I saw what I saw, and I heard the stories from Heng."
Darsem merely held the weapon out, horizontal, and inclined his head in thanks. Then he jogged back westward to Shear's position in the dark. He approached, hunched low, spear level with the ground. The stamp of horses' hooves reached him, together with mild nickering and the jangle of tack. Shear was behind low brush, and she gestured ahead. She whispered,
"They are collecting the horses."
Darsem took a quick glance. The outlaws were gathering the beasts together, yet a solid picket of crossbowers still kept watch. Again, Darsem regretted that such a competent commander should have left the Carnian fold. He waited, crouched upon his haunches, weapon readied at his shoulder for the moment he wanted. And eventually it came. Lul appeared, swinging up onto his mount. He pointed about with his sword, giving orders. Darsem backed up 3 paces, then rose to his full height and extended his arm backwards. Shear opened her mouth to say something, but closed it without speaking, obviously not wishing to distract him. He charged, thrusting his arm forward, hopping with the release. Shear rose to her feet, her masked face tracing the night sky as she followed the weapon's high, arcing flight. Shouts arose in the camp. They'd been seen. Atop his mount, Lul turned their way, pointing his sword. As if by magic, the spear sprouted from his lower torso, and he grunted with the impact. The sword fell from his nerveless fingers. He clutched at the thick haft, then slid backwards off the horse. Alarm erupted in the camp. The crossbow ranks scattered, running to any nearby mounts, throwing themselves into the saddles and kicking them into a gallop. In an instant, all had fled the clearing. Shear and Darsem waited until the dust settled, then advanced. They found the outlaw commander lying on his back, still alive and conscious, a bloodied hand on the haft standing straight above him. The man's dark eyes tracked Darsem as he closed to crouch next to him. Shear kept watch. Lul licked his bloodied lips and whispered,
"Who are you?"
"I am Darsem Ultor."
An explosion of laughter sprayed blood all over the man's beard and chest. He bared his reddened teeth in a grin.
"Should have guessed. I was at Heng.
I heard Hood's sword was there."
Darsem nodded. "I'm sorry." The commander gave a weak shrug.
"No matter. You now bring death to the south."
"That is not my intent."
The man's hand fell from the haft.
"Yet it follows you."
Darsem closed the man's staring eyes, rose, and faced Shear. Blood spattered her trousers, shirt, and mask from the battle.
"I am thinking you are no longer welcome among the caravan," she said.
"And neither are you, no doubt. I am sorry." She waved that aside.
"No matter. I was planning to return to my people anyway."
He nodded.
"I will collect our horses and go."
"I will keep them all from bothering you in the meantime."
"My thanks."
He reached out.
"Shear."
She remained erect, hands at her sides.
"Yes?"
He let go a long breath, let the hand fall.
"Fare you well."
She inclined her masked head slightly.
"You too, Sword of Hood."
She turned and jogged off. He allowed her time to speak to Horst, then went to find his horses. It was far from winter proper, yet a chill wind from the south sent shivers up Carthoron's back where he sat on a heap of rope, inspecting the tackle of the running rigging, taking from the mizzenmast. Most was far older and more worn than he would have liked. However, given the shortage of equipment, they had to make do. They hadn't the time to haul the twisted up, so Choss was in charge of repairs and caulking below decks while he handled everything aloft. It was painful to him to have to pass subpar blocks and frayed line. Yet on Mok's orders, no vendor on the island would sell them one nail or a single yard of canvas, even under the table. Still, they had managed to appropriate a few supplies. It was dark, but they were working in shifts through the night by torch and lantern light, and had even taken to sleeping in the hammocks in the crew's quarters before the mast. They had to make do with what they could scrounge or steal, and that was Grinner's area. Already he'd come through with some new line, lumber of questionable provenance, and fresh pitch. Though they'd been working like this for days, Carthoron still found it difficult to sleep, given the occasional sightings of the ship's unofficial mascot, the strange Nacht creature. That thing made him uneasy still, while Shift flatly refused to bed down on the vessel at all. Surly, for her part, remained ensconced in Smiley's, with her bodyguard rarely showing herself. Running everything, collecting money, and no doubt impatiently awaiting the day of their departure. He sat back and set his hands on his thighs, stretching his back and neck. But that was unfair. Her security was paramount to him as well, even though Geffen's organization, now under a lieutenant of his, was lying low, focused on regaining its strength. And as for Mok, with his council of captains, the man had had no reported sober day in weeks. And the local merchants, wisely perhaps, took their lead from the council. He still then, noticing that the chill wind was no longer blowing in off the bay, but luffing his shirt from the front. He peered up, puzzled, and was surprised to see thick, dark clouds massing over the island. A blaze of sheet lightning made him flinch and blink, and he rose, peering to the south. The deep purple night sky was clear there, which was odd, given that most storms rolled over them out of the south. A thick mist was now even rising off the icy waters and climbing the wharves. He backed away to the cargo hatch and called down, "Hall! Better get up here!" Their mage was already on her way up the steep stairs. She went straight to the side and peered up the shore into town. "What is it?" Carthoron asked. She turned to him, frowning her worry.
"Shadow."
"Truly?" He eyed the mist-shrouded streets.
"You think maybe it's our boy?"
A curse of alarm sounded from below, and a short, hairy shape burst from the companionway, swung over the side, and went loping up the pier to disappear into the swirling fog. Hall merely raised a brow in comment, and Carthoron nodded.
"We have to warn Surly. I'll go."
"Not alone."
Hall leaned over the cargo hatch.
"Urko, you still down there?"
"Yeah,"
came an answering bellow. She pointed a warning finger at Carthoron.
"You take your brother."
Grinner, Nadurian found, played a mean game of troughs. They sat before one of the two ground floor windows of Smiley's. Nadurian had played a lifetime, campaigning all across Quan, east to west, and now, in the unlikely figure of this burly, scarred knife fighter, he'd found a fellow adherent as steeped in the game's strategy as he. He rolled again and considered his moves while Grinner chewed a thumbnail and eyed the board. When he hadn't moved for some time, the Napan peered up at him, frowning.
"What is it?"
But Nadurian wasn't listening. For some time, a vague worry had been tugging at him despite his submersion in the game. And only now had it finally surfaced in a prickling all up and down his arms and the stirring of the small hairs of his neck. He rose from the table, jostling it and upsetting the stones. Grinner pulled away, his hands going to the yellowed horn knife grips standing from his vest.
"What is it?"
Mist shrouded the street outside beneath dark bunched clouds. Even as Nadurian watched, touching his warren, shadows cast across the shrouds of fog seemed to shift and twist all of their own accord. He went for the door.
"What is it?"
Grinner repeated. Nadurian paused.
some sort of majory.
Pointing at Grinner, he warned him, "Stay indoors," and rushed out. He made for Agalus. If anyone would be familiar with such a manifestation, it would be she. Oddly enough, though the woman's shop was only a few streets away, he almost became lost amid cobbled ways he didn't recognize. He stopped to strengthen his touch upon Rashan. Immediately, the town seemed to snap back into place all about him. He raced on. Eventually, after a number of turns that proved inexplicably wrong, he stumbled upon her shop only to find her out in the street already, a silk shawl about her shoulders, glowering at the overcast night sky.
"Is it one of the island's shadow moons?" he asked, a touch out of breath.
"No. It resembles a shadow moon, but none has been presaged for years yet. This is worse. Some fool is opening a gateway between shadow and here, and I think I know who."
"Ah, our peculiar visitor."
"Yes, and he is a greater fool than I suspected. Doesn't he understand that anything can come through?"
This gave Nadurian pause.
"Anything?" he repeated, almost in disbelief.
She nodded, furious.
"Anything. We must be ready to defend the city."
Nadurian ran a hand over his unshaven cheeks.
Ye gods, this was not what he'd signed up for.
Civilians were crowding the street now, peering about in wonderment. Agala waved them away.
"Hide indoors. It is a shadow storm. Lock your doors."
She imperiously waved him away as well.
"Send everyone indoors."
He inclined his head in acquiescence, as one could only do when Agala used that tone, and jogged off, shouting as he went,
"Lock your doors! A shadow storm!"
High above Mala's city, Tattersail sat at table with Mok and a few of his favorite captains. Untan distilled grain liquor had flowed freely, and the captains were trading banter and jokes with the admiral while Tattersail played with her knife and napkin. Mok laughed roguishly at the jokes, sending winks to her across the table, but she was not amused by what she saw as these fellows' transparent efforts at ingratiation and toadying. Mok, of course, was enjoying all the attention.
"Still no word from your sources on Nap?"
Captain Hess asked, hooking an arm over the back of his tall chair.
"None," Mok answered. "Do not worry. They were savaged just as badly."
He eyed Tattersail directly across the full length of the table.
"Some warn of a follow-up invasion or attack, but I discount it utterly."
Tattersail looked away, her grip on the silver knife tightening.
"Who will be the new flank admiral then, Mok?"
another asked, rather drunkenly. The admiral raised his brows in exaggeration.
"This is true. We've lost Kasson, haven't we?"
"Who then?"
the captain, Rhenish, pressed on, and Tattersail saw in his narrowed gaze that perhaps the man was not so drunk as he pretended. Mok just smiled in his carefree manner, and leaning forward conspiratorially, answered,
"Oh, someone at this table, no doubt?"
The seven captains eyed one another then, leaning away from their neighbors and glowering into their cups. Tattersail looked at the soot-blackened rafters far above.
Gods, so predictable.
Mok playing them against each other, as he had for years. Her gaze chanced upon Agala's dark tapestry, and she dropped her knife with a loud clang.
So dark.
The captains all stopped talking, eyeing her. Mok lifted his brows.
"Are you all right, dearest? It's too much drink, perhaps?"
He elbowed Hess on his right, and all seven captains chuckled on cue. She passed a shaky hand across her face, swallowing to calm herself.
"I'm fine. Something has disagreed with me. I think I will take some air."
Mok half rose from his seat, bowing.
"Of course, dearest. Do take care, though. It looks like rain."
She stood from the table, and all the captains rose as well, bowing. She returned the civility and made for the main terrace, where she slammed the heavy iron-bound door behind her and stared out over the city, a hand going to her throat.
"Ancient ones, no wonder I've been so jittery."
There, low over the city, a massive cyclone of energy gyred amid churning midnight clouds and flitting shadows.
"Minas! But who? How?"
She ran for Rampart Way, the nearest route down to the city below. Soon, however, she had to hike up the long dress Mok had asked her to put on for dinner. She cursed it, finally tearing off its lowest section and continuing on. The dry, dusty words of one of the texts on Warren magics regarding such manifestations marched through her mind as she went. Clouds, mists, or storms are a common byproduct of the massive differentials in pressures, humidities, and temperatures when sufficiently large portals or gates between realms are generated. Should such a differential prove large enough, the energies generated may induce a storm as destructive as any legendary maelstrom. A Gala would know what to do. She had spent her time on the south coast facing the cold grey waters of the Strait of Storms. These entities known as the Storm Riders were an interesting phenomenon, one she'd never had the inclination or opportunity to investigate before. Clearly, they represented a lingering ancient intrusion into the region. But just from where, she couldn't say. It would take generations of observation to know for certain, of course, but it appeared to her that their presence was slowly fading upon the world, grafting of an alien order as it was. The flash of sheet lightning from behind threw her shadow far out before her, and Sister of Cold Nights straightened, lifting her head. Was that? She turned to regard a dense mass of clouds slowly building over the island north of her, and nodded.
At last, perhaps my time here has not been wasted after all.
She started for the city. Carthoron set a hand on his brother's arm, holding him back from a side street.
I'm not so sure.
Urko shook off his hand.
We just head up this way to the square, the one with the broken statue.
Carthoron squinted into the dense banners of hanging mist.
Like that last turn.
Urko huffed, crossing his thick arms.
One mistake. I'm telling you, this town is not this big.
I agree.
It was strange. The moment they'd left the waterfront behind and walked up between the warehouses, it was as if they'd entered another city. The narrow, meandering streets were familiar, but not quite right. Same with the shop fronts. His brother spun then, crouching.
Did you hear that?
Carthoron squinted into the miasma.
What?
Sounded like claws scratching over stone.
A lost dog?
Damn big one,
Urko muttered. Indeed, a looming dark shadow was now moving behind the shifting curtains of mist. One impossibly large.
A trick of this strange light, Carthoron told himself. No beast could be that large.
Probably just as high as his knees, not damned near the size of a bull, just a distorted shadow. A low growling rumble reached them then, as of rocks being ground together. The very cobbles beneath their feet vibrated with it. The brothers shared a glance. Run or freeze. Carthoron slowly reached down and drew his boot knife. The tiny weapon looked comical compared to the monster that was edging in upon them. That was, if the shadows and their fears were not playing tricks upon them. A long, broad muzzle parted the vapors. It was fully as tall as their own heads. Lips drew back, snarling from wet gums, and slit eyes glared an eerie near-black before them. A heady waft of desert scent, like spice, nearly made Carthoron dizzy. Before he could act, his brother leapt upon the beast, wrapping an arm about its neck, bellowing, "Run!" But Carthoron did not run. He stared, frozen, while his brother tightened the crook of his elbow upon the beast's throat, and its eyes widened in something almost like surprise, if such a creature could be capable of such an emotion. It reared, snarling, and threw itself against the wall next to them. Both it and his brother gave animal grunts as bricks crunched and wood splintered. It staggered off, attempting to shake this impudent fool from its back, but Carthoron knew that nothing short of decapitation would ease his brother's arms once he'd clamped them round anything. They disappeared into the mist, the hound rearing and snarling, Urko half-hopping, half-dragging his feet. Carthoron moved to follow, but stopped. There was no way he would ever find them. He swore then he would honor his brother's damned fool move by beating this confounding miasma. He would escape it. Standing there, his back pressed against chill, damp stone, he decided that perhaps the way to beat it was to remain still. It may be that some logic or pattern would emerge amid the confusing chiaroscuro. Just as at sea when caught amid thick fog, you didn't look, you listened. And so he closed his eyes, listening to the night. Nadurian soon found that he no longer had to warn the citizens of Marlaz against entering the streets. It appeared they were quite familiar with these uncanny happenings. Doors were slammed and barred, and heavy shutters banged shut over windows. In no time, he was alone in a tiny, mist-laden square, and only then did it occur to him that he had no idea exactly where he was. A low rumbling reached him then, as of a beast the size of a bull exhaling, and he thought, well, perhaps not so alone. He raised his ration warren to its sizzling heights about him and waited, motionless, in a pool of absolute dark. Whatever this was, it ought to pass him by. Instead, however, twin pinpoints of a sullen bluish glow emerged from the dark, closing, growing in brilliance, and he realized with a renewed prickling of his skin that he was being stalked through the paths of his own warren of night. He shifted then, blindly, a very dangerous move, as one cannot predict just where one might emerge, and found himself in a new, equally unfamiliar cobbled way. Quickly, he crossed the street to put his back to a stone wall and tried to still his hammering heart. He had never seen that before. Some creature able to follow spores through warrens. Gods, no one would ever be able to escape such a... He stared with mounting panic at the spot where he had emerged, for there, from the shifting shadows, a monstrous paw and forelimb was emerging, followed by a long greying muzzle and twin blazing sky-blue eyes that peered right and left, scanning the street. Nadurian slowly reached over to a door next to him, offered up a silent prayer to Apsala, Lady of Thieves, and tried to lift the latch. It rose, and he ducked into a shopfront stuffed with household goods manufactured of tin. A tinsmith's. From a rear workroom, he heard someone weeping in terror. It occurred to him then to wonder why the creature had singled him out, and he realized that it must be one or both of two factors. He had been outside, and he possessed a raised warren. Reluctantly, he understood what he must do, though it scraped against the grain of decades of habit. He let his warren fall away, then froze, almost not breathing, listening to the night. Outside, claws grated against the stone cobbles of the narrow street. He swallowed and fought the mad urge to flee. No running. They are hunters. A great bull bellows of an exhalation rattled the door and sent up a massive cloud of dust from the gap beneath. The air became redolent with a sweet, spicy scent, as of mace or anise seed. The frantic need to run made his legs quiver, but he fought it, though he expected at any instant the beast to crash through the flimsy barrier. A last reverberating snort, and the claws grated once more, swiftly, as the monster ran off, called perhaps by some other scent or spoor. He let out a long, hard breath, sagging in exhaustion and relief. He reached clumsily for the door. Ancient gods, I am definitely too old for this. Tattersall passed through the streets of the High Manor district, then descended into the thick fogs that cloaked Marlaz City proper. The haze was so dense she had to raise her thigh warren to its highest extent just to penetrate the coils and hanging curtains. In the apparent quiet, She began to wonder what she was doing here and just what it was she'd hoped to accomplish. Clearly, some sort of manifestation was taking shape in the city. But what? And what could she hope to contribute? Perhaps it was one of the legendary shadow moons, though she understood such arrivals were always known long beforehand. Agela spoke of them as highly regulated and predictable, like eclipses. She turned a corner in the merchant's quarter and came face to face with several men loading goods into a wagon drawn up before an open shop front. She stared, and they froze, arms full of bolts of cloth, baskets, and kegs. One tossed his armload into the wagon and turned to his fellows.
"Well, well, mates, look what we have here."
"What are you doing?" she breathed in complete disbelief. The one who had spoken hiked up his trousers and gestured to her, grinning.
"Some sort of social affair, is it?"
Looking down, she realized how absurd she must appear, wandering the streets in a full evening gown, and that tattered and torn. Then she blinked, frowning. What she looked like was completely irrelevant. "Run! Now!" she told them. They chuckled together, two circling behind her.
"First, give us a kiss, lass," the spokesman urged. "Just a kiss, Miss High and Mighty."
The two horses of the wagon nickered then and reared in alarm, their sides quivering. The fellow glanced at them, scowling.
"See what spooked the damn horses, Graven."
One of the men crossed to the horses, but before he could grasp the throat latch of the nearest, the animals reared again, chuffing in open terror, and bolted down the street. Kegs and crates crashed to the cobbles from the open rear as the wagon clattered into the mist. Their leader looked to the clouds.
"Oh, for the love of Oppon!"
He waved his fellows away.
"Well, go get it, damn it!"
They jogged off, leaving her alone with two, the leader and one other. They moved towards her, and she retreated, coming up against the cold stone wall. Her warren sizzled in her hands, yet she found she could do nothing. She realized that she'd never before tried to use it face to face against another human being.
"Don't make me hurt you," she breathed, her voice tight with fear.
They laughed, either in ignorance of her powers or lacking true insight into her character.
"Missy," said the leader, all hungry smile, hands reaching, "you ain't gonna hurt."
Many things happened all at once then. A monstrous shape pounced from the fog, teeth tore and ripped. The men screamed, or tried to. It was more like a bursting of fluids and gore from their mouths, and she screamed. Her warren burst to life in a colossal eruption of power and light, and she was flung backwards, smashing her head against stone in an even brighter flare of brilliance. She knew nothing more. Eyes on the wet cobbles, Carthoron heard and did his best to follow reassuringly human footsteps. A couple walking calmly and with purpose through this nightmare. Who they were, he had no idea, but at least they weren't afraid. That, he realized, should either reassure him or terrify him. Presently, the footsteps stopped. He went forward a few more paces, then halted as well, and slowly raised his gaze to find two figures eyeing him from up a narrow alleyway. A pair as unlike as any two people could be. One scrawny, short and greying, the other huge, almost impossibly massive, rather like a walking dolman, and carrying a long-hafted halberd over one shoulder with a blade large enough to behead a horse. The scrawny old one pointed a warning finger.
"You should not be out this night."
Carthoron smiled mirthlessly.
"I cottoned on to that. So what are you two doing out?"
He had recognized them now. The oldster and his buddy were regulars at Coop's Hanged Man Inn, though never had he seen them so sober. Even now, he could make out the sickeningly sweet fumes of absinthe wafting from one or both of them.
"We have an errand,"
the scrawny one said.
"Yes? And you are?" Carthoron asked.
"Pharaoh,"
said the Ulster, and he nodded to his towering companion.
"Trenek."